Let's do this. The Cult of Hockey podcast. By the faithful and for the faithful, I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal. And I'm here today with Bruce McCurdy. Welcome, Bruce.
Hey, David. How are you doing?
Good, Bruce. So the Stanley Cup was handed out last night, and I was honestly pleased to see it go to the St. Louis Blues because of that remarkable, maybe as an Oilers fan, that it was. You know, I'm always holding out hope that even though the Oilers get off to these terrible starts, that they can still come back. You know, they can still come back and win the Stanley Cup even after their typical horrible start. And this is proof that every now and then that can happen. The St. Louis Blues did it. They were the worst team in the NHL early in January, I understand.
They had the lowest points total. I think they had a bunch of games in hand, if you really went through the embers, but they were 34 points in 37 games, and they wound up with 99. So they really came on gangbusters in the second half, and obviously they kept going gangbusters the entire, was it 3-4 months that the playoffs went on?
My goodness. It was the fourth time, Bruce, mm-hmm. time in the last 10 years that a team has fired its coach mid-season. Uh-huh. And gone on to win the Stanley Cup.
I believe Mike Yeo got fired the same day that Todd McClellan did, November 20th.
Could have been the Oilers, man.
That could have been the Oilers. Sorry, we were just maybe 8 to 10 players short.
Well, at least two key guys in December, Chris Russell and Oscar Klefbom. Yeah, well, that didn't help, man. It is a close league. It is a close league, and mm-hmm. there's not a whole. There, I think there's less than ever before. That separates mm-hmm. the top teams from the bottom teams. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fair comment. And you know, people will scoff that I've said that, you know, for the Russell and Klefbom hadn't gotten hurt. Oh. Well, they hadn't. Maybe the Oilers would have made the playoffs. And you just never know what's going to happen then. Like, I don't think that the Oilers were constructed to...
They didn't have the depth there. I watched those Stanley Cup final games, and I was trying to visualize the Oilers' third and fourth lines going up against any players on either team, and I was trying to visualize a scenario where they weren't getting crushed, and I couldn't.
That was fundamentally the difference. And goaltending, right? So if the Oilers... Mikko Koskinen would have had to have been the Mikko Koskinen of the 930 save percentage, you know, throughout the whole year for that to happen. But I agree, the third and the fourth lines on the Oilers were just... horrendous, but they could with Koskinen playing well. If Koskinen had been able to play well, and Russell and Klefbom had not gotten hurt, so these are some big ifs. But the Oilers aren't that far off, I don't think. They're a good goalie away, I think, and some third and fourth line additions from making the playoffs.
Well, St. Louis Blues, they certainly don't have a Connor McDavid, and I'm not sure they have a Leon Draisaitl. But they have the depth, and they had the team play going for them. And, you know, one of the reasons I was rooting for them, well, for one, I'm old. I remember them losing 12 straight games in the Stanley Cup Finals the first 3 years in the league, and then this long, long, long drought of ever getting back. So as I tweeted last night, if you're going to win 4 Stanley Cup Final games in franchise history, you might as well win them all 4 in the same year, which is what they were able to accomplish. But also all the Edmonton connections. And, you know, I have a soft spot for people that are from here or came through here along the way. Two former Oilers, Patrick Maroon and David Perron, both played a very big pivotal role for the Blues. And also three people from this area, Jay Bomister, whose dad was assistant coach for the U of A Golden Bears for many, many years. And, you know, there's sort of a dotted line connection to an old fave of mine, Claire Drake. Also, Colton Parayko from right here in St. Albert, big stud defenseman that the Oilers were going, you know, there was talk that the Oilers were going to get Parayko this year. Well, that would have been nice, eh, the way he plays. And lastly, the coach, Craig Berube from Kalahoo, Alberta, and his First Nations roots. There's a lot of good stuff in that story, and kind of thrilled to see them pull it all together and pull off such an upset. Like, the only, like, I was trying to go back through the annals of not just hockey but sports to talk, think what team came from that far out of it to win it all, and I came up with the 1914 Miracle Braves, the Boston Braves of Major League Baseball, who were famously in last place on July 4th. So So basically,
what about the Mets?
The midpoint of the season. But they came back, but they didn't come from last place. The Miracle Braves were literally last place in the league on July 4th, which is equivalent in baseball to January 3rd in hockey. And they came from last place to sweeping the World Series and becoming the world champions that year. And it was like a three-month run where they just went crazy and nobody could beat them. And that's kind of what the Blues did.
You know what I liked about the game, Bruce? And I didn't watch all of it. I went to my social dance class with my wife, where I'm learning to do swing dancing not very well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I saw the first period and the game seemed kind of over by then. And it turned out that was the case. But Bruce, the turning point of the game, as far as I could see, the old bad line change.
Ugh.
What? Okay. You're only down 1-0. You got a minute left, 10 seconds left in the period. And you a goal against in the last 10 seconds of a period. That was a
cup-winning goal.
That was a cup-winning goal. It's 2-0. And it's because Brad Marchand decides he can't gut it out. He's got to get off the ice. And he leaves Pietrangelo to go into the slot uncontested. I mean, if that happened... We see that play. We track it so I could give you an exact number, but it's about, I think we saw about maybe 5 goals this year with the Oilers for the bad line. And it's the worst of all. It is the worst of all hockey mistakes that you can make. And for all that was made of the Boston Bruins having the veteran presence and the veteran smarts and the veteran responsibility. Wow. What a mistake. And you can see it on his face. Like, you could see, I feel sorry for Brad Marchand making that mistake. It was a brain glitch in the moment. And, but what a brain glitch. What a mistake.
Yeah. Well, yeah, a bad line change in the dying seconds of a period is sort of doubly unforgivable. Because what's the fresh guy going to do? Like, he's barely going to get into the play and the horn's going to go off. That's if all goes well and they don't score while they're making the change. You know, anyway.
What would Bob Gainey have done there?
Yeah, well,
I think you would have had to sever limbs from Bob Gainey's body at that moment to get him off the ice in that situation. I don't know what Marchand was thinking. I have no idea, but I honestly, genuinely feel sorry for the guy.
Yeah, you're in the minority there. I suspect there's awful lot of haters of Brad Marchand out there. I personally, he's a wonderful hockey player. He is a complete jerk, but he is a wonderful hockey player, and that's a play you wouldn't expect from that guy. Let's put it that way. But I guess it happened, and St. Louis Pietrangelo took advantage, and bam. So
yeah, if it was any other player, he'd never live it down. But because Marchand is a smart and defensively responsible hockey player, it was so out of character, I think. It was just weird. I don't get it. I don't know. All right, let's talk Oilers, Bruce. So we're going to talk about some of the wacky trade rumors. that have come up in the last week with the Oilers, and I don't know where some of them are coming from, but they're being reported by credible hockey reporters. So we'll dig into them. And let's just quickly though. So we're going to talk about the wacky trade rumors: Corey Perry to the Oilers, Nikita Zaitsev to the Oilers, and Jesse Puljujärvi being involved somehow in the Lucic for Eriksson proposed trade. So let's talk about all those, but quickly, the Oilers made a couple moves. I don't have a lot to say about, but they kind of re-upped Keith Gretzky and Jay Woodcroft. I just see these as really solid moves made by the Edmonton Oilers. Mm-hmm. And, the Gretzky one, he's, I guess, deemed to be responsible for the last two drafts. He and Bob Green, I guess, are the main players. And we we haven't seen any great players yet out of those two drafts at the NHL level, but there's lots of arrows up with Dmitry Samarukov and Kirill Maximov from the one draft. Kailari Yamamoto's kind of maybe arrows down at this point a little bit. And then the next draft, Evan Bouchard. Well, I really liked how he played in Bakersfield, so I'm going to give him arrows up, even though Craig Button of TSN didn't put him in the top 50 prospects, which is kind of arrows down. No, I think he's a credible voice in hockey.
Absolutely.
So I throw that out the window, but I was relieved to see Bouchard play well. So I'm glad Gretzky's still involved in the draft and it looks like Bob Green is in as well. So I'm okay with that.
Well, Gretzky's also going to effectively become the AG or the general manager of Bakersfield Condors, which is what Craig McTavish was doing, of course, until he left, was managing the Condors. So they needed someone to fill that role. And Gretzky, you know, his little bit of experience as the interim GM here is going to serve him well in doing that job. And I'm not one of those that's of the boat that said that Ken Holland should have come in here and immediately conducted a red wedding on the entire executive suite of the Edmonton Oilers. He had to pick and choose. Keith Gretzky, some didn't like his role in the Tyler Seguin trade in Boston years ago. And, you know, or they tie him to Chiarelli and say, well, if Chiarelli made the moves, he must be a yes man. Well, what happens in the corporate world is, I can't remember who it was on Twitter yesterday, but they said it right. It's a little bit different in terms of accountability. Once the decision is made, and it's usually made by the decision maker, it's not in the role of the other people in the organization to say, well, that was a bad move. We should never have done that, including and even after the guy has been fired. And it's so to tie all those things on to Keith Gretzky's record, I don't know. I would have been uncomfortable with him as GM, but I don't mind him as AGM, and I don't mind him being given charge of the Bakersfield operation. Same way as last year, I didn't mind Jay Woodcroft being given charge of the Bakersfield coaching staff when there were others who said they should have canned all these coaches. Why the hell is he still around? Well, he's still around, and it turned out he was a pretty good coach, and he had a pretty good year in Bakersfield. Now he's still around for 3 more years, and I think that was a good move by Edmonton.
He not only had a good year in Bakersfield, Bruce, he had a good year with young players. And that, and this is the first time this has happened in the Oilers since, well, I think I tracked it back to like 1982 or something like that, when the Wichita team had a Charlie Huddy, and I think, I can't remember who else, maybe Andy Moog was on that team as well.
Yeah.
So it was the last time that an Oilers farm team did really well with prospects leading the way. There's been other good years for Oilers farm teams. Not many, but there's been some other good ones, including Todd Nelson had some good runs. But Nelson never did it with prospects leading the way, and Woodcroft did. Now, you could say, well, that's because Bob Green and Keith Gretzky brought in better prospects.
Yeah.
Which is fair enough. But I do think that I'm going to give some credit to Woodcroft. That team, he had those kids playing in top roles, and he had them playing well. So at least you can say he wasn't a detriment to their development, but I think we can be more generous than that and safely say that he had a hand in how well Tyler Benson, William Lagesson, Caleb Jones, Ethan Bear, Shane Starrett, Cooper Marody all played last year. So I give Woodcroft credit, and I'm glad that he's back. I think it's a smart move for him as well if he ever wants to be a head coach.
Yeah, well, when last May, I wrote a post about Woodcroft's retention and officially getting the job in Bakersfield. And I'm just going to quote the very last paragraph from my article. So youth up front, youth on the back end, youth in net. The key for Jay Woodcroft will be to play said youth and to avoid the temptation to go with vets in the key roles in pursuit of right now priorities like wins. Yes, of course, to develop players in a winning environment is a laudable goal, but in that order, please. By all means, have some tweener vets already willing and able to step in to fill shorter-term needs with the big club, but the longer-term need is an aching one for the Edmonton Oilers to develop internally a critical mass of NHL-caliber players. And I give a huge check mark to Jay Woodcroft for his performance and basically all of that in his first year in Bakersfield.
Hey, Bruce, I want to get back to Gretzky for one quick thing and about the draft, because I've been obsessed with the draft lately, looking kind of at how it works and who does well, who doesn't do well, and that kind of thing. And it's because when I looked at Ken Holland's record, I saw a GM who was a genius GM when his team went on a kind of a historic 20-year run at the draft, Bruce, where they got great players, not every year, but year after year after year. And, you know, it kind of reminded me of the Oilers' great teams of the 80s being built through the draft with Barry Fraser. And I was just trying to think, like, why did Ken Holland's team go from a great drafting team to a terrible drafting team? And why did that happen to the Oilers as well? So I looked at them and a couple other teams. And what I found was that a couple key scouts are absolutely crucial. When you look at these kind of historic runs of great drafting that the New York Islanders had in the 70s, that the Oilers had in the 80s, that Detroit had for two days. It's all, it comes down to a handful of great scouts. And Ken Holland was one of those great scouts.
Himself, yes.
He himself was one of those great scouts. And it turns out that Jimmy Devolano was also one of those great scouts. And he was also one of those great scouts in New York.
Yeah, I read your post, of course, and when you said Jimmy Devolano might go down as the greatest scout in history, I thought, you know, you got a good strong case there, because, I mean, between the Islanders and the Detroit Red Wings, I mean, we're talking about two of the great teams of the last 40 years.
And he was key to both of them. Mm-hmm. So, but what I also saw was this. There came a point in both the Oilers organization and the Detroit organization where they didn't have turnover. They kept the same scouts for 15, 20 years in both teams. And at some point, like Detroit was having kind of constant turnover in its scouts for the first 10 years of Devolano Holland. They stayed in place, but there was new people coming in constantly. So there was a different Swedish scout when they drafted Niklas Lidström as opposed to when they drafted Henrik Zetterberg. What you seem to need in amateur scouting is a great scout or two, but then constant turnover as well. You need constant new people coming in. And so how this relates to the Oilers right now is, so I checked with the Oilers' current scouting staff for the amateur scouts. They've had three guys there for about 10 years, but everyone else has been turned over in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So they have, I think, about 8 or 9 amateur scouts, and most of them are new. They have 3 older guys. And honestly, if I was running the Oilers scouting department, I'd look closely at the 3 older guys. And if they haven't had a lot of successes, if they haven't been making key recommendations in the last few years or ever, I would really look at getting rid of all 3 of them or some of them. Now, there might be 1 or 2 of them that have had some real good recommendations in recent years. But I just think it looks to me like Keith Gretzky might be a pretty good scout and Bob Green might be a pretty good scout. But they've got, how this relates to the Oilers is just keep the turnover coming. Don't get complacent, Ken Holland, like you did in Detroit, where you kept the same guys for 15 to 20 years and you've had bad results in that time period. Maybe those guys had okay results for a while, but Ken Holland's mistake was loyalty in Detroit with his amateur scouting department.
I'm looking for a key hire in the European scout department. And I think Holland, that was a big part of his success in Detroit, was all the great European players that kept stealing in the 3rd, 4th, 9th, and 11th rounds. It was crazy how late they picked some of those Hall of Famers. But Edmonton, I mean, they've had some bad luck in that department, right? They had the guy who died and, some misfortune, but they really need to get a kingpin in place in the European side of the pond.
Well, Bruce, they've had the same Finnish scout. I think his name is Verminen.
Matti Verminen.
Now, he would have recommended, Magnus Pajärvi came before him, but he would have recommended Puljujärvi. Mm-hmm. They have a new Russian scout. I think he came in 2015. I think the Russian scout's name is Narov. So Verminen's record, you're going to have to look at that. And maybe he's not the guy.
He's one of the older guys that needs to be switched up.
I just think there's a shelf life, and there's nothing wrong with this, right? It's like, it's like it where I work. Like, there's great cop reporters, but you can only be a great cop reporter for about 5 years. Like, the job burns you out. There's just jobs.
That's a legit.
That are hard to do.
Point.
It's like being a beat cop. Like, I don't think you could be the great guy, a guy on the street for more than a decade. Like, then you're going to move up the chain, right? You're going to be like the polygraph operator or something like that. you got to change. There's some jobs that are just grunt jobs that just take blinding determination and being out on the road endlessly. They're hard to do over time, I think. And I think scouts like that. Okay. Let's move on, Bruce, to the wacky rumor du jour. Cause that's what it's been. Let's start with Corey Perry to the Darren Dreger suggested that there's a big trade market for Corey Perry and the Oilers could be interested in it because of his leadership. Now, Dreger was talking about, I think, Corey Perry first being bought out in Anaheim. So it's not wacky in that Darren Dreger suggesting the Oilers should just, they should trade, Chris Russell for Corey Perry or Adam Larson for, he's just saying like, if Corey Perry gets bought out, there's going to be a market for this guy. I don't see any market. He's got 2 years left on a deal that pays him $8.6 million a year. He's banged up. He's fading. He's slow. I mean, if he didn't have a contract, could he get one for next year? I guess that's what Dreger
said. Oh, yeah. I'm sure he could.
I think he could, too. I think he could get $1 million a year from a lot of different NHL teams, including the Edmonton Oilers. I don't think it would be their first choice to give Corey, but if they couldn't get better players, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you're picking, like, do we want to bring back Tobias Reeder, zero goals, or would we rather bring back Corey Perry on our third line?
Yeah, well, he's you know, obviously has a long history of scoring, including not that long ago. This past year, he did not go well for him. He had a bad injury. He wasn't ever the fastest guy. But, I mean, the guy was drafted in 03. So what does that make him, 34 today? And he's, you know, he never was the fastest guy. So what's he got left in the tank? If you're looking at saying what the Edmonton Oilers need to do is up their pace, well, I'm not sure that Corey Perry is the answer. On the other hand, if you're saying what the Oilers need is a guy with some scoring savvy who can be in front of the net on the power play and who, you know, isn't too costly and isn't too costly to acquire, then sure, you think about him. There's a lot of people that are real haters of Corey Perry. They put him on the Brad Marchand level of being a rat. Well, I don't know. I have several guys I'd rank.
You love those rats when they're on your team.
Even lower than those two guys.
But, come on. Like when Esa Tiikkanen was on the Oilers,
yeah,
we loved him. And the Oilers have had numerous Kevin McClelland, Esa Tiikkanen, and Raffy Torres. I mean, come on. What was dirtier than Raffy Torres' sneaky shoulder or sneaky elbow that took out Milan Mihalik in the playoffs that year in 2006? I mean, that was a totally ratty, dirty play. And we were all clapping. Like, come on. Everyone was cheering that on. And so when a player like that's on your own team, you tend to love him. Is that not the truth?
Well, it's partly the truth. I loved Esa Tiikkanen, but you know what? I rack my memory banks to remember ever seeing a play where I thought Esa Tiikkanen deliberately tried to hurt someone, and I can't.
He never did.
Kind of a goofball. Some of these other guys, and Raffy Torres certainly would be one who would take advantage of and hit to hurt.
Okay, I will only speak to my own reaction of that hit. I liked it. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Well, I'll say that historically it was a series-turning hit. It changed the tone of that entire series. This was game two. The Oilers were in a process of falling behind 2-0. And then they won the next 4 games in a row when Mihalik didn't play. But it was more not just the absence of the one player, but it was more things turned at that moment somehow. But
okay, I'll take that as a yes.
It worked.
It's like Messier, Bruce. I mean, you can't be a Messier fan. You cannot be a Marc Messier fan unless you liked the extreme violence he would now and then employ, extreme illegal ultra-violence he would now and then employ to help the Oilers win a hockey game. And the problem has historically been that the NHL does not punish players severely enough for those plays. So what should have happened to Raffy Torres is, he should have missed the rest of that series.
He should. The modern day, they would be suspended. And as my friend Low Tide says, you can't unsee Reg Fleming's brain. I mean, we know stuff about brain injuries now that we didn't know during the days of Raffy Torres, certainly not during the days of Marc Messier. That has changed. And the NHL is still swimming against the current in this regard, but they're at least attending to the headshot issue to a degree. I mean, we even saw Connor McDavid get suspended this year, and they've become more consistent about applying that. I'm 100% certain that hit now. And I mean, Raffy Torres paid for that type of hit many times later in his career, and they stacked up. Eventually, he got 41 games, didn't he, for a hit that was no different from that, really.
You know, that's a really good point. So I'm saying that I like the hit then. I don't know if an Oilers player made that kind of hit now, if I would like it. If I'm completely honest, I think I might not, because I think you're right. I think we all have been really impacted by these stories of brain injuries of Derek Boogaard and Rippon, is that was his name?
Rick Rippon, yeah.
Rippon and other players, and what we know about NFL football players. And I think there's a lot more knowledge, sensitivity, understanding that these kind of plays really are off limits. Right. So maybe if Rafi Torres did that now, I wouldn't. So like, what would be the equivalent of that? Who on the Oilers? We don't really have well, if Zach Kassian did that to a player, yeah, we all like the Logan Couture hit, but it wasn't as violent. That was a different kind of hit. It wasn't a headshot.
He could have got suspended for that, but could have. But yeah,
he didn't even get a penalty, did he?
Yeah, that was
another series change.
The modern NHL, David. You know how many penalties were called last night in Game 7 between two very physical teams? One penalty, and you know what it was for? Delay a game, right? All's fair in love and war. You can try and crush the other guy in any means possible, but don't you dare shoot that damn puck over that damn glass or you're going to the penalty box.
Sure makes it interesting that they have that call because it's the only one they can't get out of. Yeah. So let's segue, Bruce. Do you think that Milan Lucic is, because a heavy hockey team won the Stanley Cup Finals, that changes Milan Lucic's trade value at all?
Yes.
So he's got more value today than he had
more
yesterday.
Value. It's still a negative value, and it's still substantially negative, but it's less negative than before.
Okay, how much do you think, if Milan Lucic was today a UFA, how much do you think he would get? And I'll give you my answer first, because I've actually looked into this, and I've found comparables like Ryan Reeves, Cal Clutterbuck, Matt Martin, and I'm saying if Milan Lucic was a free agent today, he would get as much as a three-year contract. This is the maximum. As much as a three-year contract for as much as $2 million a year. And he might get a two-year contract for $2.5 million a year. And he might get a one-year contract for $3 million a year. So that's my – do you think I'm completely off base there or off base at all? Or
I don't. I mean, Ryan Reeves is a reasonable comparison. And I mean, obviously, he's got a far longer, far more illustrious track record. But if you look in terms of what they bring today, which any smart person doing signings has to do, they're fairly comparable, and you know they play the big, heavy game, and you know it has some value, and I think more now that we've seen not just the playoffs that just happened, but how those playoffs were officiated, there's more value. Again, I mean, the NHL, like a lot of people have been saying, now that it's going to a speed and skill league, and certainly it was, but there's always a bit of ebb and flow between those things. Hockey's always had skill and speed, and hockey's always had toughness and intimidation. And the game is always going to be some kind of balance between those two things. I do think overall trending towards skill and speed, but by no means is it a one-way street.
Now, if I were an NHL GM, there's no way I would sign Milan Lucic personally. I should say that. I just don't value him enough, like what he brings enough for me to give him a contract. Like, honestly, that's my take on the player. Even as a fourth liner, I would rather have other players. Well, maybe for $1 million a year for Milan Lucic, would I sign that as an NHL? Maybe, you know, if my team really needed toughness. And the good news is, Bruce, a lot of teams really do need toughness. Yeah. So I think there is a market for Milan Lucic, and I'm actually going to be disappointed if he's not moved this summer. That said, you know, so we're saying maybe he's got, maybe even over 4 years, he's got like $1.5 million of value a year, maybe $2 million a year over 4 years. That's a pretty long term for Milan Lucic. But he's got some value. But the problem is his contract, of course, is $6 million for 4 years in a buyout-proof contract. Now, the good news for the Oilers in moving him, Bruce, is if they move him, if he agrees to waive his no movement clause, it will be up to his new team and Lucic whether that no movement clause exists. I think in the de facto position is it's void, but they can agree, the new team and Lucic can agree, to continue it on if they want. So That means that the Oilers will, if in moving Lucic, they would get out of having to protect him in the coming expansion draft. But the new team also could get out of having to protect him if Lucic and the new team agree to that. And I think that they would. So this is a real plus for the Oilers in moving him. And it's an incentive to move Lucic. But but the new team doesn't have to have that burden of the no movement clause, which they could also then send him to the minors, Bruce, if he didn't have the no movement clause. So it is something that Lucic would give up, but I think he would have to give that up in order to be moved. So that's another consideration here.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's all or nothing scenario, or if they could negotiate sort of a lesser version of a limited no trade or something with the new club. Like, I don't know the nuts and bolts of the CBA to that degree, nor do I frankly want to.
Yeah, it's always a little tough to deal with these issues when you're writing about it, because we have to, because we write about it to know all the ins and outs. But I asked Cap Friendly that about this particular situation, right. and that's the
what a wonderful source that is.
Who is Cap Friendly? What a great guy he is. Yeah. Here, I'm going to read what he says about the no movement clause. The clause can travel with the player even if he consents to being traded or is claimed on waivers. This requires that the acquiring team sign an addendum to the contract, ensuring that the clause does in fact travel with the player and the addendum is written by the player's agent. If the acquiring team refuses to sign the addendum and the player waives the clause anyway, at that point, the clause may be nullified. So,
so it doesn't quite say if the agent can write an addendum that changes it to reduce it. But anyway, that's... and bolts. That's so one of the.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry. I called the Lucic contract the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, with the term, the cap hit, the no movement clause, and the buyout proof bonus structure. And of course, the no movement clause has its own hammer, which is this business of having to protect the guy in the expansion draft. Like, it is an absolutely brutal contract that has no win on it, unless there's some way to divest it. And it's going to cost to divest. It's going to cost bringing a lousy asset back, or, you know, an underperforming asset back. It's going to cost in terms of probably salary retention. You know, there's no way to treat it as a net positive. All I'm saying is this year's playoffs, the negative value has maybe shrunk a little bit.
So, I think we're in agreement. It's, you know, depending on the term, his value is about $2 million a year, so he's got about $4 million negative value. And anyway, so Bruce, the good news is that Darren Dreger was saying he thinks there's about 30 to 35 really terrible contracts around the NHL that teams are wanting to move. So there's no shortage of trading partners for Milan Lucic, depending on which teams he's willing to move to. And I think that's a much smaller list. I bet you there's probably about 10 teams that he would, maybe 15 that it would be willing to go to, maybe even fewer for all we know. We know Vancouver seems to be on the list. So Vancouver is one of those teams that has a terrible contract, Louis Erickson. We've talked about this a little bit in the past. The interesting thing this week is that Elliot Friedman, who is, you know, along with Bob McKenzie, I would say Bob McKenzie is the most credible source by far.
Yes.
And then Friedman's next. And then everyone else is after that. So Friedman was speculating, and it was kind of, he was musing, he was kind of talking out loud about trying to figure out how an Erickson for Lucic trade might work. Mm-hmm. And he brought up the idea that Jesse Puljujärvi might be involved in the trade. And he didn't use the word as a sweetener, but that seemed to be the implication to me, at least. But he didn't say sweetener, but from reading his comments, it seemed like to grease the wheels of this trade, he seemed to be saying that Puljujärvi would be included in it. That's how I read his comments. Did you read them otherwise?
No, I couldn't make sense of them other than the assumption being that Puljujärvi has almost no value whatsoever at this point, which, you know, because to me, the Lucic and Erickson contracts are more or less equally bad. You can't, if the Oilers were to acquire Erickson, first of all, you trade for a guy, you can't buy him out for a year. So they're stuck with him for 1 year. If they were to buy him out in a year from now, 2020, it would cost a cap hit of $5.67 million on the first year, because there's so much of it, again, in bonus structure, that all they would save would be $333,000. And with that $333,000, they'd have to buy a replacement player who would cost at least $700,000. So you tell me how that comes out as a win on the salary cap structure. I can't make it add up.
His contract's also buyout proof, essentially.
The 2021, I think the last year they could buy it out.
The one difference in the contract is that he can be sent to the minors. He just has a no trade clause.
Yeah, you wouldn't have to protect him.
So you wouldn't have to protect him, and you wouldn't have to keep him. You don't even have to buy him out to save $1 million a year. You just send him to the minors to do that, and you could do that at once as soon as you get him. And Bruce, here's the difference between Lucic and Eriksson. I don't think Eriksson, I think there's a real question if he was a free agent now, whether another team would take a chance on him. He might not get an NHL contract. He's going to be 34. He's coming off 3 years straight of about 10 goals a year. I mean, he's like Benoit Pouliot at this stage. Pouliot had 11 goals. He was a PK guy, and he couldn't get a contract. Why would Louis Eriksson get a contract? Now, he might, but he would only get $1 million a year. At most, Lou Eriksson. I don't believe it. Like, if anyone told me he would get more than that, I do not believe that. So,
I'm not sure he's much more than UC Jokinen was, you know, when Oilers got him last year.
He may be less because Jokinen was closer to having a good season than Eriksson is now.
Yeah, well, he's got three, you know, 10-goal seasons. Like, a 10-goal player in the modern NHL has some value as a third liner. He's a penalty killer. He's not any sort of a physical player, but, you know, he has some pluses, but he's just nowhere close to being a $6 million player.
And he's not a $2 million a year player either. He's not Toby Reeder.
He's not Ryan Reeves.
No, he's not Ryan Reeves or Milan Lucic. He's a $1 million. He's UC Jokinen. Okay, I'll give you that. He's somewhere between UC Jokinen and Benoit Pouliot, who couldn't get a contract, and UC Jokinen got $1.1 million. So let's give him the benefit of. But so I think Eriksson has less value than Lucic, but he does have the 1 year less. And I think all of that balances out to these two players probably being in a trade. I don't see Edmonton needing to add a sweetener to this deal. So the idea that they would is I don't buy that. And this because I think Vancouver needs toughness and is desperate for toughness. And Puljujarvi, I mean. Like, I get it that Jesse Puljujärvi doesn't have much value right now. I think he could probably get a second-round draft pick for the guy. But, I mean, the Oilers, I think, are nuts to trade him because why would you trade low on Jesse Puljujärvi? I still see a 21-year-old player with all kinds of talent, big guy who can skate and can make a play. You hold on to that guy and hope that it was his handling and his injuries and his lack of maturity that were holding him back. And his injuries and his maturity, those are things that are going to fade with time.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think Ken Holland would treat it as a priority. He said he spoke to the agent once and they haven't talked any further. Well, get on that and talk.
I never buy when they say that, Bruce.
Yeah, no, this is probably true. But talk to the agent, talk to the player. And, you know, the point being that, yes, the handling of Puljujärvi in Edmonton has been highly questionable. But guess what? Peter Chiarelli is gone. Todd McClellan is gone. Ken Hitchcock is gone. There's a new sheriff in town. There's another new sheriff behind the bench. And convince the player that he's getting a fresh start without having to change teams to do it.
Yeah, this whole, like, whether Ken Holland has talked to the agent or not. I mean, they're in contract negotiations right now. So I always think they always play that kind of close to the vest. And, like, I never really believe what they're saying or not. Like, yes, the positive news, I think, is, yes, Puljujärvi is in Edmonton. He is training, he's rehabbing with the Edmonton Oilers. Mm-hmm. He's here now. He's acclimating to the city. Mm-hmm. He's working with the team. He's working with the trainers. Do I think that Ken Holland hasn't gone down to the rinkside and had a chat with the kid? I mean, it's possible, but Ken Holland seems like an affable, friendly person, people person. I suspect that he's maybe even had a coffee with the guy. Like, I don't know. It's surprising mm-hmm. to me. Anyway, you do whatever it takes to sign Jesse Puljujärvi up to a 1 or 2 year deal, and you have another go at seeing if you can make it with this player. Anything else to me is like you're just giving him away for nothing. So why would you?
If you're going to throw in Jesse Puljujärvi in that trade to get Lucic out of town, now instead of asking for Louis Eriksson, you're asking for Brandon Sutter.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and you're still taking back a negative contract, but one that isn't quite so negative.
2 years. Sutter has 2 years, I think, at 4.5,
something like that.
And he might be I think he's got more valuable than Louis. He's more valuable than Louis Eriksson at this point.
He's a right shooting defensive center. Yeah. Anyway, he's no great shakes at this point. But the other possible sweetener between any kind of Edmonton and Vancouver deal, and Vancouver's hosting the draft this year, Edmonton's picking number 8. Vancouver's picking number 10. So they're just right there together. But if Vancouver wants to make a little bit of a splash at their own draft, any kind of trade up. So whether what other kind of value could be extracted, but that is one little bargaining chip because it's still got a good player at 10.
Yeah, and again, I don't believe the Oilers need to sweeten it, but we'll see. Well, maybe
not specifically Lucic for Erickson. I kind of agree it's a wash.
I much prefer the James Neal option in Calgary because at least Neal's a younger player. He's closer to having a good year. He just had one bad year, and his contract is much more buyoutable. It's not loaded with bonuses, so you get much more of a benefit if you buy out Neal at any point. So I don't see them trading. I that's the trade I'd like to see is James Neal for Milan Lucic. And no, I'm not worried about Milan Lucic going to the Calgary Flames and at all. I'm not worried about it at all. So I think the Oilers have a plenty tough team with Cassian, Kara, and Darnell Nurse. They've got people who and Milan Lucic. If I was a GM, he's not a player I would be looking at the signs. So
how about a three-way trade between Vancouver, Calgary, and Edmonton? I think that if that type of trade ever happened, regardless of the constituents, those three geographic rivals somehow getting together to make a trade, I think the earth would stop spinning and start rotating it from east to west.
Well, Laddie Smead got traded
to Calgary. Calgary. Two of them together is rare enough, but that somehow hook in all three of them, I just don't see that happening.
Steve Staios got traded to the Flames.
Yeah.
So these things happen. I don't know. It wouldn't. I'm honestly high. I hope Milan Lucic just traded this summer at this point. That's what I want to see. I think he wants to go, and I think the Oilers should move him. Okay, the last wacky trade rumor is just today, Darren Dreger. Now, he's not always right in his trade rumors, and some of them make the Oilers. Like, he wanted the – like, he was saying Cam Talbot is going to get a first-round draft pick for the New York Rangers. Cam Talbot didn't get a first-round draft pick. So this is – sometimes I feel like Dreger kind of throws the Oilers out there, kind of throws them under the bus as a team that's going to have to overpay or pay too much. And so he has them interested in Nikita Zaitsev, a third-pairing defenseman in Toronto who hardly scores any points. And is for the next 5 years, is going to earn $4.5 million a year. Bruce, I cannot see any trade between the Edmonton Oilers and the Toronto Maple Leafs that makes any sense involving Nikita Zaitsev, except for Milan Lucic moving to Toronto. But the Toronto Maple Leafs can't afford Lucic. They can't do that. So that's the only thing that makes sense from an Oilers perspective. But there's nothing that makes sense from a Toronto perspective. Like, I mean, that doesn't make sense for the Toronto perspective. I mean, lots of things would make sense. If they could get a Chris Russell for Zaitsev, they would do that in a second, I'm sure. But the Oilers, they're not going to take on that contract. Do you see any way they would take on that contract?
I can't. I mean, 5 years at 4.5? You know, I mean, that makes the Chris Russell contract look pretty good. It's only 4x4.
Two more years left.
He had 36 points as an NHL rookie, age 25, 2 years ago, but he was also minus 22 that year. And since then, they pushed him down in the rotation a little bit. I don't think he's third pairing, David, because he's still over 20 minutes a game. But he's had 13, 14 points the last 2 years. And, I mean, I just don't think that fits what the Oilers need. I mean, they've already got Adam Larson
Third pairing on a team with good defensemen, Bruce, is what I mean by that. You're right. Okay. He's like Chris Russell. He's a 4D on a team with bad D or mediocre D. But on a team with decent defensemen, either he's not playing or he's on your third pairing. I think that's a fair comment. So that's what I was meaning by that.
But
you're right. By his usage, he played second pairing minutes last year in Toronto. But that was a team that was hurting for right shot D-men and hurting for D-men. Other than Morgan Riley, period. And I don't – maybe Vancouver will want him. Maybe Vancouver is desperate for a defenseman. But, I mean, he's not – anyway, the Oilers are stacked with young defensemen. And why would you bring in Zaitsev? You got Evan Bouchard. You got Ethan Bear in the minors. You got – he's not a better – is he a better player than Matt Benning? I doubt it. So –
Well, I prefer Matt Benning at $1.9 million for 1 year than I do Nikita Zaitsev 4.5 for five. I mean, that's the balance you have to make in the cap era. It's not just player for player, but literally the contract and how you fit it in. The Oilers just don't have room. I don't know why they keep coming up with these rumors that somehow the Oilers are going to take these $4 and $5 and $7 million players off of other teams. I mean, just stop it. There's no place to put them.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to move any player.
It's a landfill out here or something. You know, like, stop it.
Sounds like it's going to be hard to dump any contract this year, Bruce. Like there's all these contracts out there. Everyone's looking to dump them. So maybe one or two teams are going to get lucky and find the right situation where they can move the player to Ottawa and the Ottawa's willing to do it. But I don't know, like I haven't really studied other teams that have cap space to see if there really are all these teams, but I don't think there are. And so I think if you're going to move a bad contract at this point, it's going to be for a bad contract. And and we've all got to get our heads around that. That's the deal. So if Milan Lucic just traded for a bad contract, I don't want to see anyone complaining about that because A, it gets rid of that no movement clause and it gives everyone a fresh start. And hopefully we'll get back a somewhat lesser bad contract for a somewhat equal player.
At the same time, you can't just be saying, well, the Oilers need to get rid of Milan Lucic no matter what.
I agree.
Lucic is the problem. No, the contract is the problem. And if you're going to get an equally bad contract back, well, guess what? You still got a bad contract on your books.
Like, and I think he's a much bad. Yeah. Sorry. I think he's a much better fit on other teams than he is on the Oilers. I think because some teams really do need toughness. And he provides that he is a great fit on a number of teams. Not at that price, but in return for a bad contract coming this way. He really makes sense for Vancouver. In my eyes. I could see why they'd want him. And that's another reason I'm against a sweetener in that deal. Bruce, let's leave it there for now. So unless you have something more, any other last thought or.
No, just my only real thought is, well, we should mention probably the addition of Tom Anselmi as the chief cook and bottle washer. But on the Case Group side of the equation, not Oilers Entertainment Group, and I think they've kind of cleaned up the chain of command, even as they added a guy there. And otherwise, Holland's priorities this week have all seemed to be at the AHL level, right, with Keith Gretzky, Jay Woodcroft, re-signing Patrick Russell, re-signing Brad Malone, you know, just before that. Like, that's all of the re-signings, all of the free agents Edmonton had on the Oilers roster at the end of the season are still free agents, and the number of available spots on the roster is shrinking and shrinking. And there's only, there's 42 contracts now on the 50-man list, and we still have 8 free agents in Edmonton. Well, obviously, some of them are doomed, but the number of options available is shrinking. So,
yeah. Don't bring back Toby Reeder, whatever you do. Okay. All right. Thanks, Bruce. Thanks for talking.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.